Is Homeland Security interested in the Spindrift Prayer Research Program? We'll check in with Bill Sweet on that and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Bill Sweet with us, your phone calls as well. Bill, Homeland Security, what's their interest in this program?
Well, it's very interesting. It seems like for the last 6 months, I've been getting a lot of inquiries from law enforcement and Homeland Security into the Spindrift. I've been asking my Spindrift friends what they think this is all about. And I've written the people back. They always write back, you know, they were like the research and they're interested in parallelism. I think that I have never gotten a straight answer of why they might be interested. But I think it's because the Spindrift research has always been on top of the terrorism problem through researching prayer. When people go to the Spindrift website, spindriftresearch.org, and they go down to question 10, that's all on this very question you're asking about Homeland Security and prayer and the terrorism situation. And also, you were asking earlier about negative prayer and evil prayer. Well, it seems like in the 21st century, the epitome of evil prayer comes from our Islamic terrorists. I think that it'd be hard for any other religion to compete with them in that category. They get the gold medal for negative prayer. We can certainly see that because the terrorism always begins with prayers. 9/11 began with prayers, and Spindrift was trying to point all this out even before 9/11, because what we did was is that when we were testing people from different religions, we were looking into testing some folks from a mosque out here, and we found, and this is like in the late 80s and 1980s, and things we were finding about, it was just culturally so different of a way to pray that we didn't know how we could test that the way they pray. And how are they going to pray for the experience of getting up and down and bending and all this? But anyway, then we also got copies of some of the prayers that were translated into English that had to do with killing Jews and killing infidels and all this, and you know, it really shocked us. So we tried to point out to people that we should be listening to these prayers. We tried to warn people. This is before 9/11. And so then 9/11 happened, and we've been still accenting that. And I think that that is sort of what has gotten their interest.
Good point. Good
because, again, what goes on underneath this in the unconscious thought? You know, we can see buildings falling, and we can see airplanes crashing, and people being killed up with bomb vests and all that. That's all in the surface. We can see that. But what's underneath it, unfortunately, is prayer. In the unconscious, that's the area that we really should deal with, and we should take that more seriously because that is the seed that's being planted that grows and becomes the terrorism. So my speculation that is what it is. It is just very interesting to see that there's all this interest from people in law enforcement in Spindrift. And if this isn't the reason, it's just an interesting coincidence. Mm-hmm. But in the last 6 months, it's just a whole load of people coming from that area of law enforcement, Homeland Security. It's just kind of interesting. And of course, when you read, you probably have some of that in front of you. When you read about the insights that Spindrift has on the prayers of Islam, it is a unique angle.
Did you test non-believers of prayer as well as believers?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question because we did test some atheists, and I kind of wish we had tested some more. And what we found was is that they could get a goal-directed result, but they couldn't get a non-goal-directed result. So there is something about the human ego and intention. And I mean, you can convey your thought as a psychic thought, and it, you know, if it has spirituality attached to it, the goal will be guided into a good thing. But they could get a goal-directed result, and the goal-directed result manipulated the organisms. Now, we had one atheist skeptic who came in and didn't do anything during the test. And after the test was over, he said that your results showed you didn't do anything. That was kind of interesting. They just sat there and did nothing, thinking that the test would go off and maybe record something. So that was an interesting thing too. I think that just from knowing some of these skeptics that they and atheists, non-believers, that they some of them have very strong thoughts. I mean, you watch some of these people on TV who are they're just intense. That Penn Teller and Bill Maher. I bet if they took a test, they would get a powerful result because they're so focused on their non-belief that it has the intention of producing an effect. And we all know the effect of people who don't believe. I'm sure you can think of many times when somebody walks into a room and they change the whole atmosphere because they bring a negative belief into the room.
They're negative. Negative people, that's true.
Right.
I mean, they have a cloud over their heads.
Yeah, it's really a phenomenon a lot of us can experience. That's almost empirical. You can almost point to examples of that. So it's wild stuff. Now, I noticed that during your break, you did the commercial again for the Patriot Food Supply.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I know you had ties to Missouri, and it made me think of this. My sister and I just were in Branson, Missouri. My sister is a fan, follower of the Letterman singing group, and the Letterman had a big convention there, and she was there, and I went with her. And we were also there to audition bands. My sister and I helped
hire
bands.
Well, Branson's a great spot for that.
Oh, it is. But guess what? As long as I was there, I said to my sister, you know, Jim, you remember Jim and Tammy Baker?
Yeah.
Well, Jim Baker was given a 45-year prison sentence, but he got out after 5 years. And now, right outside of Branson, he started a whole new complex. And I said, Cody, we got to go over there. I got to go over and see this. I got to go see his television studio and see his setup. So we went over to see Jim Baker and his selling condos, and he's back in business, and he's got this television show, and his big thing now is disaster, famine, doomsday is coming, and the Book of Revelation tells us so.
Yeah.
And
how's he doing?
He's into the storing food, I think, too.
Well, he's right about that. Is he doing well?
That they're doing well. That was an unbelievable setup, multi-million-dollar setup. And the television studio, the equipment was the top, newest equipment.
That is
but
amazing.
I just thought I had to share that with you because that was just so wild. I had to see it. To believe it.
Well, let's go to some calls here for you. We'll go to Donna in Johannesburg, California. Hey, Donna, go ahead.
Hi, George. Haven't talked to you. Happy holidays.
It's been a while. You too.
Yeah. Anyway, I've always believed that God knows what I need anyway before I even pray. But a special thing happened to me this morning. And I haven't seen my daughter in 20 years. And just recently, she started texting me, good morning, Mommy, I love you, and it would just light me up. I mean,
sure.
I was just, you know, and I have been praying that she would not be so bitter towards me, but I felt I didn't deserve the prayer because it was my fault, you know, that I hadn't gone to see her. But she talked to my sister, and my sister told her, pray about it. And she did. And now everything's changed. And believe me, prayer works. And I believe that when people get together and ask a specific thing, that powerful energy also works.
It does not. But let me ask you this. Adana, thanks for sharing that story with us. How does it work? What is it doing? What is it tapping into in this cosmos to make it work?
George, caller there actually hit on maybe the answer to the question. She said she thought God knew her needs before she did. There are these archetypes out there, things that we're that if we attune to, we will get a result. And so they're fixed in consciousness out there, and we feel, you know, God knows what those are, and then he knows what our needs are. So when we are praying, we are, and at least if you have a goal-directed prayer that has the right motive, or a non-goal-directed prayer that always has the right motive, you are trying to align with the need. You want your needs met, and it may not be what you think they are. So sometimes you don't want to outline what you want because God knows what you want before you do it. And again, it's this on this unconscious level. We have to really explore this unconscious level more. So the way prayer works is that we are aligning with a solution that is already established in consciousness, and we just have to find that principle and align with it, and we have to pray to align with it. So what you're doing in prayer, you are aligning with the solution that is already there, unknown to you at this point. But your unconscious knows all this. So this is why we have to investigate this. Bruce Klingbeil, one of the founders of Spindrift, had a very interesting phrase that I always kind of liked. He said, there's so much going on in the unconscious that's knowledge. He says he calls it unknowing knowing. You don't know you know it, but it's unknowing knowing. I always like that.
Were you in shock when you found out that they were dead?
Oh, it was awful. We had all kinds of things planned and it threw everything off, and we were worried that maybe since I was a spokesman for Spindrift, I would be next. It didn't make any sense. It's completely a mystery.
It's weird. Did you go into hiding for a while?
We talked about it in the family here. We talked about contacting the police and things, and I sort of probably kind of did for the first week, because I had to do a lot of pulling things together that were falling apart. So I kind of did by default. And an interesting thing that happened, by the way, chapter 10 in my book, A Journey into Prayer by Bill Sweet, is all about the so-called suicides. And in there, there's quite a lot that was able to be pinned down on what was going on. I had all kinds of people, well, Paul, give me descriptions, police, friends, and everything else. And a lot of weird things happened at the same time. This is something you read about in the book. There's just a lot of negativity around it. I was, the day after or something, I was right here where I am now talking to you on the phone, and I was typing up notes, trying to get things together, and one of the legs in the chair broke, and I fell down and got injured. So there was this negativity. This leg just broke off the chair, and I fell over, and I was injured. So it's just, that was negative plus negative plus negative. It causes breaks, and that was a very strange experience. And I have a lot of things like that in the book, and it's I think that a lot of people, the problem with the paranormal, as you probably know sometimes, and including prayer, that some of these things, when they actually become close to being proven or close to having some modicum of credibility, then it starts to scare people. This psychology thing comes up where you're called approach avoidance. Well, now you've got to this point. Now that I'm approaching it, now it's getting to be real. Now I'm going to back away from it. And I think a lot of that happened here at this time, too, when this happened to the founders of Spindrift. It was a total shock, and it still is a shock, and it leaves a lot of mysteries.
When did they die?
That was a long time ago at this point, 1993.
93. Okay, let's go to Ethan in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Ethan, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us.
Yes. Thanks. And my condolences to you, George, regarding your sister. I know this is a challenging time. Yeah.
Thank you, Bill.
And I, too, have been challenged with, relationship and a marriage and my kids. And I just keep bumping into person after person. I keep just asking and looking for support. And it's so hard to find people that are hopeful nowadays. So I kind of was siding with you during the cloud over the head part. But I really had two things I wanted to mention. I had a question: is it possible to bridge the subconscious with the conscience, maybe through sleep deprivation? And the other part then was a water prayer. If you had time, I'd like to share that with you.
Well, sure. I would say a goal, that's a good goal, is for us to become more and more conscious. Mm-hmm. The way we see it at Spindrift is that the reason Jesus Christ was so effective is that very little of him, if at all, was unconscious. He was like this totally conscious being, so he was aware of everything. So his unconscious thoughts, they were conscious thoughts, and that should probably be the goal of all of us. Now, what I've read is that human beings generally are about 96% unconscious, and they're only about 4% is conscious, and that would be a lot. A lot of people aren't even in that. Even our top geniuses like Einstein are like only 95, 96% conscious of the rest of what's going on in the unconscious. Now, if we can find a way to become more conscious of our thoughts and what's going on in the unconscious, we would become terrifically psychic and spiritually minded. That's actually what it's all about. It's becoming more aware. It's getting rid of the unconscious and making it more conscious. There, We in our culture make this division between conscious and unconscious, but in the ultimate sense, I don't think there is really an unconscious. We are conscious beings, and that's what we have to discover.
Well, and you know, that kind of brings to mind there's a previous guest on that talked about, you know, when we act out of fear and anger, you know, we're using the parasympathetic nervous system, and you know, the more primitive reptilian part of our brain, and when we're acting out of love, and you know, and that's what I keep bumping into, is that so many people are just, well, just send her down the river and just do this and try to get control of the kids. And it's so hard to find people that are hopeful. And I have been hurt and hurt and hurt. And I can't tell you how, you know, the kind of stuff I've been through is just horrendous. But each time I come back with, you know, forgiveness and love and just understanding, I mean, human beings are completely, you know, very complex.
Forgiveness is a tough one. That is, if you can do that, that's great. We all have to work on that. I have a tough time with that sometimes. But if we keep on pouring in forgiveness, love, and having these things displace the negativity in us, maybe on an individual basis, we can start improving ourselves, because we are all feeling this collective pull now downward, and it is tough. But we can't do anything about it consciously. We won't solve anything by consciousness. It's how we have to work on ourselves and get our skill sets and our spirituality and our qualitative quality thoughts in us and improve ourselves first on an individual basis before we can spread this out to other people.
Bill, there's no doubt, in my opinion, we've been talking about it for about 2 hours, that it works. We do question how it works, this connection with what's out there. I would assume that when this universe was created, all of this was part of the plan. Would you agree?
All the part of us, the discovery that we are busy discovering things for ourselves?
Yes,
I think so. I think of the planet as a school yard and school room, and some of us are slow learners, some of us are have to repeat grades, and some of us, not too many people skip grades, but at least if you can stay in your grade level, you're doing well these days.
Absolutely.
we certainly do need to investigate these things, maybe ultimately for survival purposes. It's ironic, when we were talking about negative prayer and the terrorist prayers earlier, we were thinking in Spindrift that, you know, maybe what will actually drive science to look into prayer will be the floods of avalanches of these negative prayers that the terrorists are putting out, when they actually, you know, well, we're going to have to investigate prayer because of its negative power and negative effects. Well, whatever it takes to look at it. It won't be because of the beneficial effects, because the overwhelming negativity. And then now we have something else that I pray about personally is that, you know, some people need a sense of humor, like this North Korea thing, and it's misinterpreting that, you know, it's a sense of humor, it's satire, but they don't have it.
They don't have a sense of humor.
No, and they need it.
All right, Bill, we're going to come back and take some final phone calls with you. Plus, we'll also hear, of course, the letter from Michael. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I'll be heading back to Los Angeles tomorrow, so Connie Willis is going to fill in for me with a great program, no doubt. So make sure you're part of the listening audience there. We're going to come back in a moment with our friend Bill Sweet as we take the rest of your calls. And also, don't forget, coming up, a letter from Michael, our tradition during Christmas. I hope you have enjoyed our Christmas Eve and Christmas night programs. And we shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Bill Sweet, of course, as we've been talking about prayer, how it works, why it works. And we shall take your final phone calls here. And also, again, the letter from Michael from the great broadcaster, Lee Allen, just ahead. They don't make them that way anymore. Those are classic announcers from the past, to be sure. Bill, A Journey into Prayer, where do people pick up the book?
Well, they can get it through the website. They go to the spindriftresearch.org and click Book News. There's the link to my publisher, and there's the link to Amazon.com on there. And the A Journey into Prayer, Pioneers of Prayer in the Laboratory, Agents of Science or Satan, that's the full title of the book. The book is in hardcover, softcover, and in Kindle. So I appreciate that. Anybody have any questions, let me know. And the book is kind of an interesting experiment in writing. I took a writing idea. The back of the book is like page 330 on is one type of writing, kind of an internet style of writing. And then if it's for a person, people want to read quickly, but if somebody wants to read more slowly, they can start at the beginning to the end. So I mentioned earlier about the humor problem in North Korea over Kim Jong-un and this movie and everything.
Yep, yep.
This has happened before, George. Do you remember there was a movie scare back in 2005? Albert Brooks made a comedy called Looking for Comedy in the Muslim World. Do you remember that?
Right.
And many movie theaters were scared to show it in their theaters because they thought there was a fatwa out against them.
Well, what about Sacha Baron's The Dictator? That was another one of those, too.
It was?
You know, so who knows? But you're right. People need to laugh.
They sure do. They sure do. And there was a sci-fi movie. I think it was Nicolas Cage. It was called 2012. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
I heard a producer from that say that a scene was dropped from the script where the Holy Al-Haram Mosque in Mecca is destroyed. The scene was dropped out of fear of a fatwa.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I guess Sony could have dropped the portion of the assassination of Kim. You know,
just leave it to the imagination,
and yeah, or something like that. But let us go to the phones. Mike is in Amarillo, Texas, first time caller. Mike, go ahead.
George, it's an honor to be with you and Bill. I appreciate all the work that you are doing on this topic. And George, I would just say that you know, earlier tonight you talked about going to the funeral of a friend, and it made you question whether life just ended at our physical death or we had spiritual afterlife. And I would just say to hold on to that belief of spiritual afterlife.
Yes.
I've got a couple of things that I wanted to bring into the conversation. One is about Jesus's walk, and then about my own experience and what I call my salvation experience. And just from what Bill was talking about, when Jesus was brought in through John the Baptist, the Holy Spirit. And I really think that this is the energy force that Bill is talking about and his work is surrounding, whereas before, you know, the outreach towards God or towards, you know, a supreme energy source was through sacrifices and idols and this kind of thing. And so Christ, you know, brought in the Holy Spirit, which I think is an energy source. And Bill, you were talking about, I think you were kind of getting to the point about predestination, or is this energy force just something that's kind of random out there? Well, in my own experience, back when I was in college, I'm 55 years old now, I was searching through prayer, all night prayer, for, you know, what my life ought to be and whether or not I should even continue to live. And I was asking for some guidance there and whether or not I should stay on earth in life. Well, I felt myself and I began to leave my body. I believe God or the Holy Spirit was taking me away from earth. And then I said, well, what would you have me to do? Well, at that moment, a vision came forward, like many people talk about, an angelic being appeared in my bedroom, and I said, well, and the communication was such that, okay, if you want me to be here, just tell me what you want me to do. Well, at that moment, I began rambling in tongues, and I was so startled that I ran out of my room, out into the yard, and I just fell into the yard, and at that point in time, I felt like Niagara Falls was going through my body. And what I count that is that the Holy Spirit was coming into me and changing my life right then. And I laid in the yard for a while, and I got up, and I just felt like a completely new person. I didn't have an evil thought in my mind. And I said, well, God, what would you have me to do? What do you want me to do? And just as plain as the three of us are talking to each other now, a voice said, you're going to go into education. Well, I was getting a political science degree, and I said, no, I'm not. I'm not going into education. And the voice said, you're going into education. I said, no, I'm not. And that second time I said it, I was struck to the ground. And so there I was on all fours trying to get up, and I couldn't get up. And then I said, okay, I'm going into education. And I was immediately able to stand up.
Huh. Well, why would that happen like that, Bill? And we're almost out of time here.
Well, I just want to say that experiences are subjective, and I'm grateful for your experience. And I would agree that there is a Holy Spirit that is a consciousness that is revealing truth and spirit to us. These human experiences are too big to test in the laboratory. You subjectively know your own evidence for what happened, but that is a hard thing to convey to other people. Either they believe you or they disbelieve you. So it's a dramatic experience you had. I would hope that we could come up with parts of it that could be looked at. I know that the speaking in tongues thing is something that could actually be tested by science. I don't know why they wouldn't. There's all these claims that speaking in tongues is speaking a foreign language. I think that'd be pretty easy to track down, but I don't know anybody who's ever tried to do it.
Bill, we are out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program this Christmas night for us. Most gracious of you to do that.
Well, I thank you for having me as a guest again. It's good hearing your voice again, George.
It's been a while. Okay, my friend, you be well. Bill Sweet, of course, this Christmas night. Many years ago, a fellow broadcaster in Detroit, Lee Allen, recorded what we now call our Christmas tradition, a letter from Michael. It's about World War II, and for some, it's kind of shocking. For others, of course, it's proof that something does exist. Here it is.
Merry Christmas, everybody. My name is Lee Allen, and the story you're about to hear has become a Christmas tradition. It's been broadcast for over 25 years on radio stations all over America. The story was given to me by Ed Hardy, news director of a radio station much like this one. It was a copy of a letter written by a young Marine named Michael, who was hospitalized after being wounded on a Korean battlefield. The letter was written home to his mother, but it was first seen and read by a Navy chaplain. In the letter, Michael describes what happened to him on that lonely, frozen battlefield. When the chaplain first saw the letter, he talked with the boy's mother, the sergeant in charge of the boy's patrol, and the patrol members themselves. Privately, they will all still tell you that what you're about to hear is a true story. We simply read the letter at Christmas time and let it stand on its own merit. The sergeant, the patrol members, and Michael are real people. The story is the letter, a copy of the original. A letter from Michael. Dear Mom, I wouldn't dare write this letter to anyone but you, because no one else would believe it. Maybe even you'll find it hard, but I've got to tell somebody. But first off, I'm in a hospital. Now, don't worry, you hear me? Don't worry. I was wounded, but I'm okay. You understand? Okay. The doctor says I'll be up and around in a month, but that isn't what I want to tell you. Remember when I joined the Marines last year? Remember when I left, how you told me to say a prayer to St. Michael every day? You really didn't have to tell me that. Ever since I can remember, you always told me to pray to St. Michael the Archangel. You even named me after him. Well, I always have. When I got to Korea, I prayed even harder. Remember the prayer you taught me? Michael, Michael of the morning, fresh court of heaven adorning. You know the rest of it. Well, I said it every day. Sometimes when I was marching, sometimes resting, but always before I went to sleep. I even got some of the other fellows to say it. Well, one day I was with an advanced detail way up forward of the front lines. I was plodding along in the bitter cold. My breath was like cigar smoke. I thought I knew every guy in a patrol, and alongside of me comes another Marine I'd never met before. He was bigger than any Marine I'd ever seen. He must have been 6'4" and built in proportion. Gave me a feeling of security to have such a buddy near. Anyway, there we were, trudging along. Rest of the patrol spread out. Just to start a conversation, I said, "Cold, ain't it?" And then I laughed. Here I was with a good chance of getting killed any minute, and I'm talking about the weather. My companion seemed to understand. I heard him laugh softly. I looked at him. "I've never seen you before. I thought I knew every man in the outfit. I just joined at the last minute, he replied. The name is Michael.
Is that so? I said. That's my name, too.
I know, he said. And then went on, Michael, Michael of the morning.
I was too amazed to say anything for a minute. How did he know my name and the prayer that you had taught me? Then I smiled to myself.
Every guy in the outfit knew about me. Hadn't I taught the prayer to anyone who'd listen? Why, now and then they even referred to me as Saint Michael.
Neither of us spoke for a time, and then he broke the silence. We're going to have some trouble up ahead.
He must have been in fine physical shape, for he was breathing so lightly I couldn't see his breath.
Mine poured out in great clouds. There was no smile on his face now.
Trouble ahead, I thought to myself.
Well, with the enemy all around us, that's no great revelation. Snow began to fall in great thick globs. In a brief moment, the whole countryside was blotted out, and I was marching in a white fog of wet, sticky particles. My companion disappeared.
Michael!
I shouted in sudden alarm. I felt his hand on my arm. His voice was rich and strong. This will stop shortly.
His prophecy proved to be correct. In a few minutes, the snow stopped as abruptly as it had begun. The sun was a hard, shining disk. I looked back for the rest of the patrol. There was no one in sight. We lost him in that heavy fall of snow. I looked ahead as we came over a little rise. Mom, my heart stopped. There were seven of them.
In their padded pants and jackets and funny little hats. Only there wasn't anything funny about them now. Seven rifles were aimed at us.
Down, Michael!
I screamed and hit the frozen earth. I heard those rifles fire almost as one.
I heard the bullets.
But there was Michael, still standing.
Mom, those guys couldn't have missed. Not at that range.
I expected to see him literally blown to bits.
But there he stood, making no effort to fire himself. He was paralyzed with fear.
It happens sometimes, Mom, even to the bravest.
He was like a bird, fascinated by a snake.
At least, that's what I thought then. I jumped up to pull him down and felt a sudden flame in my chest. I often wondered what it felt like to be hit. Now, I know. I remember feeling strong arms about me. Arms that laid me ever so gently on a pillow of snow. I opened my eyes for one last look.
I was dying. Maybe I was even dead.
I remember thinking, well, this isn't so bad. Maybe I was looking into the sun.
Maybe I was in shock.
But it seemed I saw Michael standing erect again. Only this time, his face was shining with terrible splendor. As I say, maybe it was the sun in my eyes, but he seemed to change as I watched him.
He grew bigger.
His arms stretched out wide. Maybe it was the snow falling again, but there was a brightness around him, like the wings of an angel. In his hand was a sword.
A sword that flashed with a million lights.
Well, that's the last thing I remember till the rest of the fellows came up and found me. I don't know how much time had passed, but now and then I had a moment's respite from the pain. Fever.
I remember telling them of the enemy just ahead. Where's Michael? I asked.
I saw them look at one another.
Where's who?
Asked one.
Michael. Michael, that big Marine I was walking with just before the snow squall hit us.
Kid, said the sergeant, you weren't walking with anyone. I had my eyes on you the whole time. You were getting too far out. I was just going to call you in when you disappeared in the snow.
He looked at me curiously.
How'd you do it, kid?
How'd I do what?
I asked, half angry despite my wound.
This big Marine named Michael and I were just...
Son, said the sergeant kindly, I picked this outfit myself, and there just ain't another Michael in it.
You're the only Mike in it.
He paused for a moment. Just how'd you do it, kid?
We heard shots.
There hasn't been a shot fired from your rifle.
And there isn't a bit of lead in them seven bodies over the hill there. I didn't say anything. What could I say? I could only look open-mouthed with amazement. It was then the sergeant spoke again. "Kid," he said gently, "every one of those seven bodies over the hill there was killed by a sword stroke." "That's all I can tell you, Mom. As I say, it may have been the sun in my eyes. It may have been the cold or the pain. But that's what happened. Love, Michael."
Merry Christmas, everyone. For Dan Galante, Trisha Pepe, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.